According to those ubiquitous late-night commercials, we start to lose energy when we hit 40. Well, no wonder Indiana is so preoccupied with energy. On its last birthday, it turned 205. Unlike the stars of those TV spots, however, the state couldn't give a hoot about some age-busting, libido-boosting supplement. Its focus is coal, or more accurately, the state's all but inevitable transition from coal to natural gas and increasingly to renewable sources of energy, such as wind, sunlight, vegetation, and organic waste. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this week's show, we'll do our best to illuminate competing visions of Indiana's energy future. Should we place our hopes in the construction of small modular nuclear reactors, in the development of utility-scale solar and wind farms, or in the wholesale embrace of home and neighborhood-level power generation? Or should we, as some policymakers suggest, adopt an all-of-the-above strategy? It promises to be an electric discussion, so don't go away. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house. Our subject is Indiana's energy future, and I promised an electric discussion. I figure I'll supply the wind, or at least the hot air, while my guests provide the proverbial sunlight. Put another way, I'm the fossil, and they're the fuel. Joining me are Republican Senator Eric Cook of Bedford, chair of the Senate Utilities Committee, Democratic Senator Shelley Yoder of Bloomington, a member of that committee, Kerwin Olson, executive director of the Citizens Action Coalition, which bills itself as Indiana's oldest and largest consumer and environmental advocacy group, and Peter Schubert, director of the Richard G. Lugar Center for Renewable Energy at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis, where he's also a professor in the Purdue School of Engineering and Technology. Thank you all for being here. Energy affects everybody from one end of the state to another, so I hope people are tuning in and listening. Let me start, Eric Cook, with you. And this is a somewhat flippant question, but bear with me. So back in 2019, the General Assembly created a policy task force to look at energy policy here, two-year run. Last year in 2021 session, you reconstituted the committee, lease on life for 2 years, so that's still in progress. Meanwhile, as I look at legislation that's related to energy making its way through the General Assembly this session, I see that one bill that's received overwhelming support in both the House and Senate would require the Utility Regulatory Commission to provides annual studies and data about where we're getting energy and the cost and so forth and so on. Here's the question. When do we stop studying and when do we start doing?
Well, first of all, thanks, John, for having me on the show. And a lot of the legislation you have seen the last couple of years on energy has come out of the work of the task force. And it's one of these situations, the more we dig, the more we find. And an example of that is Dr. Schubert's participation on the task force, bringing to our attention an exciting technology that also ended up in a bill this year. But reporting is important to us, and it's important to stakeholders in the field. And this field is moving so dynamically and so quickly that reporting is even more important. And so we put a lot of value in the reports we get from the commission and institutions like Purdue, who also do energy-related research, to validate what we're doing and, you know, to supplement the work that we do here. So it's very worthwhile. And the extension of the task force, as you noted, I think is a reflection of the dynamism that is going on right now in this space.
Senator Shelley Yoder, weigh in on that. You're relatively new to the General Assembly, but not new to the issue. Is it important to continue to study this and looking at it as a continuum and not just a slice of life? I guess it's like construction, highway construction in Indiana. It's never really done.
Well, information is never a bad thing. The more we know, the more confident we can move toward some solutions. But we cannot undervalue the importance of gathering data. And that's what this bill is going to also provide, is information, not just to study, but data, so that we can make the most informed, the best informed decisions, and as quickly as we can moving forward. Because as we move to carbon neutrality, which we need to quickly, it's going to take data. It's going to take research, and we need to be able to respond quickly. And what I appreciated, Senator Cook had mentioned the work that Peter Schubert had presented to our task force this interim session on pumped hydro storage, and we were able to move some legislation through with that. But also the work that we did with that we're working on with electric vehicles. We need an infrastructure, and that came out of study and data. And while maybe the legislation isn't perfect yet. We're trying to get it there for all Hoosiers, because it's going to be important that we have infrastructure for electric vehicles.
And I should point out, the task force's priority this time around is a little different in that it deals with electricity distribution and electric vehicles, perhaps more than the initial two-year study. Kerwin Olson, you've watched these issues. You've seen things studied. You contributed to many of those studies. I was taken with a comment you made to an industry publication last summer. You said, it's ground zero here in Indiana in respect to energy. Who knows where this crazy train is going? Is it a crazy train, and if so, is it powered by a renewable source of energy?
Well, there's a lot of reasons that it's a crazy train and we're ground zero in Indiana. First of all, we are retiring an enormous amount of coal capacity and energy in the state of Indiana that needs to be replaced with something. Second, we have the largest two regional transmission organizations in the country that intersect our state, which allows Indiana markets to sell energy to a large portion of the country and allows Indiana to access energy from a large portion of the country, as well as the expansive pipeline network that traverses our state. So we are deep in the energy conversation with respect to both generation and transmission here in our state, and we'll see where it goes.
Peter Schubert, a lot of university centers and institutes and policy groups are sort of obscure, esoteric entities, don't get a lot of time in the spotlight. You seem to be in the right place at the right time as Indiana moves forward with this transition and your group, which is looking at renewables. Do you feel like in the eye of the storm?
When I first started 10 years ago at the Lugar Center for Renewable Energy, the senator said, university research is good, but let's turn it into jobs and revenues. So I take that very seriously. So we have 43 research members in the Indianapolis and Bloomington campus. And our goal is to try to get our technologies out of the university labs and start creating jobs and helping the benefits come to the Hoosiers that we serve.
And are you seeing benefits yet from your perspective? Again, you're not a partisan necessarily. You have the perspective, the more 30,000 foot, as they say. Are we making progress already as a state?
As the two senators mentioned, we're looking into using abandoned coal mines as the lower reservoir for pump storage hydro. A Bloomington-based company got a SBIR, a Small Business Innovative Research Grant, from the Department of Energy, and we did our first feasibility study. It looks very good economically. We're waiting to hear next month if we'll get the phase two, which will be to create a small-scale demo and have people be able to come and kick the tires and look to see if we can turn this into a business that Indiana can do at home first and then export to our neighbors on all sides.
Eric Cook, we often hear the General Assembly say, we're not here to pick winners and losers. The market forces, this is a state that appreciates the market, and business forces will dictate what direction we move as a state. We have already seen two of the largest utilities in the state, NIPSCO and Duke, already say that they're retiring fossil fuels. I think Duke, by their target, is 2035. That was just an announcement earlier this month. Why not just sit back and let the market take us that direction?
Well, because in Indiana, the electricity sector is regulated. We are a vertically integrated, regulated system. Now, the REMCs and the municipals operate largely outside of that, but we are a regulated system, and our five investor-owned utilities produce what are called integrated resource plans, which is every 3 years. And that's sort of their looking ahead and their vision for the future. And a lot of stakeholders, including organizations like Kerwin's, have the opportunity to participate in that stakeholder process. So we watch very closely the integrated resource plans that are being produced by the utilities, and that gives us some early on information about where they think they are headed. Now, those evolve over time. Those are iterative in nature, but those are a pretty good glimpse, at least what the companies think the future looks like.
And of course, Shelley Yoder, I think it was 2 years ago, there was I know people didn't like the word moratorium, but the brakes were put on the move for utilities that wanted to go retire their fossil fuel plants or coal plants. And the General Assembly said, whoa, wait, did that make sense? Or again, is this something that the General Assembly's interceding where it doesn't need to?
I think when it comes to moving us toward carbon neutrality, it's going to be all hands on deck, and we need to do it as quickly as we can. And that's going to take some serious effort. And what I appreciate is I know all Americans saw what happened to Texas last year, and we are fortunate in Indiana to have a completely different system. We do have regulation. However, Texas doesn't exist in a vacuum. It impacts electricity and energy across the entire grid. So what we've been able to do is really look at that study, learn from it. But I think one of the issues that we can look at is how can we bring all Hoosiers to the table to take ownership in this and to want to be part of moving us to carbon neutrality. Net metering, community solar, these are aspects when it comes to residential use that we can all be part of the solution. And I want to see us moving in that direction as well.
Well, you had a couple of bills certainly dealing with net metering that would have extended the life expectancy of net metering and perhaps given it renewed popularity. Neither bill got a hearing, and I think that was the same for even Republicans who had offered similar legislation. So Kerman Olson, let me ask you this. You know, there's sort of three, this is a gross oversimplification, three ways to move. You know, it's either with and net metering feeds into the notion of having home, individual home or community-based generation, whether that's rooftop solar panels, whether that's, you know, somebody puts up a wind turbine in his or her backyard. And that's where net metering comes in, because that's the notion that if I generate additional power, I can sell it back to the grid and basically recoup my investment. Another option, of course, is the large scale, the utility types of wind farm and solar farms. And then it was mentioned earlier, nuclear possibility, the modular nuclear reactors. Kerman Olson, what of those three do you like, or are you going to go for option four? Tell us what do you see as the right course here?
Well, we like the first two options. We are not fans of small modular reactors or nuclear power. We believe we're going to need large-scale utility renewable projects. But we also believe that, the energy markets are moving towards the distribution side of the things and away from transmission. And so we believe strongly in policies and incentives that encourage customers to generate their own energy, which provides enormous value to the grid by delaying or even preventing exorbitant spending on massive baseload power plants and significant infrastructure to deliver that power. We believe in an energy system that everybody can participate in the energy economy, which drives down costs for consumers statewide, puts money in the pockets of everyday Hoosiers, reduces emissions, improves our environment, improves public health. So we'd like to see a system that balances between utility scale, commercial scale projects, but also recognizes the inherent value of customer sited, customer owned, local generation at the distribution level that provides enormous benefits to everybody and reduces costs to all Hoosiers.
Peter Schubert, how important is that notion of we're all in this together and we should have buy-in, and if that means putting up a solar panel on my roof, that's great? Or is that just sort of, does it feel good, but it's really not going to get us in the same place that, say, a huge multi-megawatt facility would in terms of renewables?
We have to look at the Luger Center at three different levels. One is residential, then there's commercial, industrial, and then utility scale. At the utility scale, new installations of wind and solar are cheaper on a per kilowatt hour basis compared to new coal or new natural gas. But as you mentioned earlier, they're not dispatchable. So that's why this pumped storage hydro is so important, because that allows us to have grid scale storage so we can increase the percentage of renewables in our portfolio and still provide the reliability we need for a manufacturing state like Indiana.
Senator Cook, it seems sometimes there might be conflicting messages. We talk about the individual buy-in and individual rooftop solar panels. And certainly there's legislation that seems to be moving along that would, for instance, bar homeowners associations from saying you can't have these. I mean, they'd still have some say, but it would basically clear a path for individuals to erect those types of things. But then again, as I mentioned earlier, you see the net metering legislation, all of it, as far as I know, not a single bill got a hearing, which would suggest that maybe rooftop isn't important. Is there a conflicting message there?
Well, first of all, I think I got to really underscore the fact that in this whole discussion of the energy transition, we can't lose sight of reliability. And Dr. Schubert alluded to the fact that often distributed generation is not dispatchable. So we have to start with the premise that we need to be ultimately backed up by 24/7 on demand baseload power and build from there. So this summer, the task force is going to take a look at distributed generation as a whole. Net metering is one small piece of that. There are lots of different kinds of distributed generation. And a year or two ago, FERC issued FERC Order 222, which was very fundamental in a way of policy and regulation. And this year, we authorized the IURC, our state regulatory commission, to start rulemaking based upon FERC Order 222, so that we can have on-ramps for all different types of distributed generation, not just net metering, but many other different forms.
So, Shelley Yoder, we talk about, rooftop, and maybe it's my term, the conflicting messages. I'm not trying to put words in anybody's mouth. But let's move from that individual scale to the utility scale. And there might seem to be some perhaps conflicting messages as well, in that we saw the push last session and again this session to have uniform siting standards for wind farms and solar farms, so that it's the NIMBY, not in my backyard situation, isn't going to run squarely into the push to become a renewable energy state. Didn't work last year. This year it was going to be voluntary. There would be financial incentives attached if your community wanted to be solar or wind ready, I think was the term, you'd get perhaps some money. The legislation is still alive, but now the financial incentives have been taken out. Again, which is it? Are we encouraging people to do that or not?
Industrial-sized renewable installations are absolutely a direction that we need to be heading in for Indiana. And it's a job creator. It makes sure that we're moving towards that carbon neutrality. But last session, the bill that we considered and ended up not getting through was one that made it mandatory state regulated rules around these industrial installations, whereas this year we are incentivizing. And that is an important piece in this, is getting all Hoosiers to participate, to engage, to know, not just in how we're generating electricity, but consumption, making sure that we're all feeling that we're a part of this. And the bill that we are now working on to make sure that it does get through is one that is incentivizing and giving local communities a say in the direction and in empowering in how they are moving their own communities and the state towards carbon neutrality.
Nobody would be forced to embrace that if their constituents didn't want to. And I guess I thought I was under the impression that and never say never in the General Assembly till you adjourn sine die, that the financial incentives actually were out, in part because nobody knew where the funding was coming from. Kerwin Olson, regardless, we've seen, again, the large-scale utilities move in this direction already. How important is it to have incentives, whether it's dealing with siting or just some kind of economic incentive, or is this something where just let the trends continue, in your view?
Well, I think wind and solar can almost stand on their own two feet right now without the incentives themselves. I think the incentives are directed at those communities who are being resistant to that development for one reason or another. So I think the incentives were, now you have a carrot without the carrot. If you don't have the incentives in the bill, what's the motivation for those communities who might be resistant to those, to invite those into those communities? So I think those incentives were more designed for those communities to get that investment in there. Because again, we have a lot of wind, a lot of solar developers looking at the state of Indiana to develop in Indiana. In fact, there was a recent article that showed Indiana was fourth in the country in terms of renewable development projects in some stage of the pipeline, behind only California, Texas, and New York. So we are an enormous opportunity right now in the state of Indiana to be a huge player and participant in this energy transition. And we should certainly do all we can to take advantage of that for the benefit of local economies, the state economies, and customers.
Peter Schubert, are we indeed poised to be a huge player? And how do you address the concerns of people? And I'm guessing Senator Cook hears from some of these folks. I know Ed Soliday, his counterpart in the House, says he has. And that's from people who say, coal, fossil fuels, that's all we want. This other stuff is a bunch of, here today, gone tomorrow. Let's stick with what got us here over the past 205 years as a state. What do you tell those folks?
We see this in our students, that they're really eager to share the same vision that Senator Yoder is espousing. And we also see that in businesses that want to move to Indiana and set up their headquarters here. They're really looking for a better portfolio than we've had traditionally. So Indiana has a history of being both a leader and a risk averse, but it's a balance that seems to be the character of Hoosiers, in my opinion. And I think that we've got really great research happening. We've got a lot of entrepreneurs working on these technologies. And my hope is that the General Assembly can together help pave the way for these things to move forward at the right pace so that we have people who look at Indiana as a place to live, work, and have fun.
Eric Cook, we talked earlier, one of you mentioned nuclear reactors. Certainly that has gotten a lot of attention, I guess, just by its nature. You know, we read about wind, we read about solar, we read about biomass, but nuclear, I mean, we haven't had interest in that, perhaps as a state, since Marble Hill was, discontinued that project back in, 1984. How realistic is that push to bring modular nuclear reactors to the state of Indiana?
Well, that was my bill. It passed strongly out of both houses, going to be on its way to the governor. It's been one of the more exciting bills this session. The technology has really improved, and these are small, safe, modular factory-built units, usually underground and cased in concrete. It's not that image of the round dome and the billowing tower.
They're about a third the size or less from what we'd all imagine, or maybe even less than that.
Or even smaller. And what we like about it, it checks a lot of different boxes. It gives us that 24/7 baseload power. It's clean. It's dispatchable. And so it checks a lot of the different policy boxes. And so as we work toward what we hope to build is an all of the above energy strategy, that's going to be an important part of it over the course of the next decade.
Shelley Yoder, as I looked at the bill as it moved through, most of the no's were Democrats who were uncomfortable. Why is that, do you think? Is it safety concerns, or is it seeing that this is not the right policy?
I think it did have some bipartisan support.
It did. It was not right down the line. You're right.
And as I recall, there were concerns about financing. And so those were, very sincere concerns that we trust that the commission will be able to work out before it approves any petitions.
All right. Shelley Yoder, concerns?
My concern is one. It was just my hearing from my constituents. Here's one area that we should spend a little bit more time studying. We didn't have a chance to talk about this in the 21st Century Energy Task Force, and there is currently not one other state that has an up and running. There are other projects that have tried to get off the ground, but they've been more than double the cost, and that expense is on the backs of ratepayers. And it's been extended and actually getting started. It's cost more. It's been delayed in actually finishing the project. So ratepayers are paying for this, but there's actually no finished project. And for Indiana to, we can put it nuclear waste in whatever big, small, container. But at the end of the day, it's still nuclear waste. And it's still going to be around for years, thousands of years. We need to have a plan, and it needs further study. And those were my concerns.
Kerwin Olson, I know that critics have pointed to South Carolina and Georgia, where projects have kind of ballooned and ratepayers have had to bear the brunt of it on the nuclear front. What's your concern about nuclear?
Well, our concern about the bill is about customers. Because what we have is a technology that, while the nuclear industry certainly talks a good game, they haven't delivered much in the last several decades. This is a technology that is not commercially available. We're not even sure how much it's going to cost yet. And so the idea that we're going to put ratepayers on the hook to pay for these things while they're being developed, permitted, licensed, designed, and exacerbate the affordability crisis, we think is a bridge too far. We need to protect Indiana consumers from these potential cost overages. And furthermore, we also know that these aren't going to be available, according to many, until the early 2030s. So why are we doing this in 2022? Let the industry and the utilities prove that they're cost effective and safe before we put struggling Hoosier ratepayers on the hook for these exorbitant costs.
Peter Schubert, last word. We're almost out of time. It'll have to be a short word. But Fast forward 20, 30 years, or 10, 20 years from now, let's make it that, and I reconvene this panel, and you'll all join me again, and hopefully I'll be here. I am the fossil, but I'll be here to ask the same questions. Tell me what Indiana's energy makeup looks like at that point.
It'll be diverse. It'll have a mix of baseload and distributed generation. There'll be grid-scale storage. We'll have ports for people to charge their electric vehicles, as well as to refuel their hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. We'll have cars flying through the air. We'll have people happy. We'll be growing food and be in the breadbasket of the United States and the crossroads of the nation.
Okay, well, we'll put on your calendar. We'll be back then in 10 years and see how accurate your assessment is. Thank you all for weighing in with your thoughts. Obviously, a lot of knowledge here, a lot of passion, and I thank you for joining us. My guests have been Republican Senator Eric Cook of Bedford, Democratic Senator Shelley Yoder of Bloomington, Kerwin Olson, Executive Director of the Citizens Action Coalition, and Peter Schubert, Director of the Lugar Center for Renewable Energy at IUPUI. And time now for our weekly conversation with Indiana lawmakers, always energetic analyst Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hanna News Service. Ed, we covered a lot of territory. What did we not cover in the roundtable?
I think one of the things that certainly deserves some consideration was the cost of the small nuclear reactors. You know, that's obviously going to play a part in how soon we see something, but what's been really interesting this session has been to follow the carbon sequestration project and the evolution from last year. There's a lot of support for the idea, but the devil's been in the details. We've gone from just a simple or not so simple sequestration project to a situation where you've got legislation that covers the question of using the land of others without compensation and then providing the company that's involved in sequestration with immunity for any kind of liability and the lack of any kind of compensation for perceived problems. And it's really become a very interesting situation that the House defeated one of the bills related to it because of all of those complications and in particular from pressure from the Indiana Farm Bureau over the land rights. And it was kind of a bridge too far for some. And then on top of that, now you've got one of the companies that's involved in this wanting to produce hydrogen as a power source from some of the carbon, and that becomes an additional complication. So this is really growing in terms of the scope of the whole effort.
Before it was just about dealing with the byproduct of energy generation. Now, in theory, it could become energy generation. Ed, anything else? We're in the final stretch here, only a few weeks to go. Lively week, things are picking up.
Yeah, a crazy session, just in terms of all kinds of the issues with committee hearings. We've seen lengthy committee hearings and all kinds of issues with and at committee hearings. And one big situation that happened this week on Wednesday was a 9-hour hearing on the firearms bill that we discussed last week that may have become one of the wildest hearings that I think I've seen in more than 30 years at the legislature.
Well, and that's just a taste. I'm sure we'll be seeing more coming down the pipeline here as we round out the session. Ed, as always, appreciate your insight. Government regulations, unwelcome barriers to economic development, or essential guardrails to protect the public. How the General Assembly will navigate that issue on the next Indiana Lawmakers. Until next week, take care.